This is Arts Alive for Saturday, April 16th. I'm Alan Chapman. Brian Lauritsen is on vacation. Earlier this year, the music community was struck by the loss of a Pulitzer Prize-winning composer, Stephen Stuckey. But he was more than just a stellar compositional talent, and in fact, in Los Angeles, we feel his absence acutely. Because for 21 years, the L.A. Philharmonic enjoyed a close affiliation with Stuckey. He was former music director Esa-Pekka Salonen's consulting composer for new music, and the two became, as Stuckey once said, musical brothers.
I cannot even remember exactly the first time I met him, but I do remember how much I liked him straight away. It happened several times that Steve would call me to say that I absolutely have to listen to this piece by that young composer. This kind of concern and willingness to help never stopped.
Composer and former L.A. Phil music director Esa-Pekka Salonen. More from him, plus L.A. Phil president and CEO Deborah Borda, in tribute to composer Stephen Stuckey, in a moment. Also on the show today, a chat with film composer Harry Gregson-Williams, who scored everything from animated comedy to a new historical drama airing tonight. And film critic Kenneth Turan tells us about a film where the voice talent shines. Plus, on Ask the Dean, why are so many manuscripts miraculously found after being lost for centuries? That's our question for Dean Rob Cutietta of the USC Thornton School of Music. First, in 2004, the L.A. Phil premiered Stephen Stuckey's second concerto for orchestra, which they'd commissioned from him. The next year, the piece won the Pulitzer Prize for Music. "I didn't know about this until 5 minutes ago," Stuckey told an L.A. Times reporter who reached him at his Cornell University office. "I was just minding my own business, teaching theory." Many would say that was typical of Stuckey, to be more concerned about his students than reveling in his own accomplishment. Stuckey earned his doctorate in musical arts degree at Cornell and taught there for more than three decades. In 2014, he joined the faculty of the Juilliard School. But L.A. Phil president and CEO Deborah Borda told KUSC's Gail Eichenthal that she had to remind herself that Stuckey lived on the other side of the country, because he was such an omnipresent part of the L.A. Phil for so long.
Andre Previn first brought Steve to L.A. for a piece called Dream Waltzes. No one had ever heard of Stephen Stuckey. And then he just kind of stuck around for the next more than 20 years and developed such a close relationship with the next music director of the L.A. Philharmonic, Esa-Pekka Salonen.
It's so sort of funny to think back that Andre Previn was the person who brought Steve to the L.A. Phil, because, you know, I think of Steve so much as in the moment and in our time. And of course, you know, there were very dark times for the L.A. Phil around the late 90s and the millennial turn. And there was a question of, you know, whether the hall would be built. There was a question actually about whether the orchestra might slide into bankruptcy. And what I appreciated so much about Steve, he was a complete optimist. He was always optimistic about what the future would bring. Steve was a great gentleman, but he had a wicked sense of humor. He was so funny. Esa-Pekka and Steve, you know, you can't imagine two drier wits, but the wit flew. And he was a kind person. I think, again, that relates to his optimism, to his seeing a better future.
And you had him running the Young Composers program as well.
Well, he wasn't just running the Young Composers program. He thought it up. That was Steve. When he first brought the idea up, you know, high school composers, I have to say, I wasn't immediately charmed by it, but he convinced me, and he directed us at the LA Phil into providing a service at a very, very high and specialized level, which really encompasses our philosophy of being very community-based, but also making sure that we leave room for that very top echelon of talent that somebody has to pay attention to. And Steve convinced us that was necessary.
The LA Phil's Deborah Borda. She says losing Stuckey has been like losing a sibling. In 2012, the LA Phil premiered Stuckey's Symphony, which the composer told the LA Times starts in a dark and pessimistic way and becomes light and bright and optimistic as it goes. It has an emotional arc and not one I knew I was making until halfway through. Just 2 years ago, the tongue-in-cheek opera The Classical Style by Stuckey and librettist Jeremy Denk became the first opera to premiere at the Ojai Festival. Stuckey told KUSC's Gail Eichenthal that throughout his career as a composer, his time with the LA Phil acted as a creative anchor.
It's such a great orchestra. It's such a great and welcoming and open city. And my time at the Philharmonic has been the principal education and the bulk, really, of my professional life. This is my musical home. Besides that, Esa-Pekka became my closest friend in the composing business. And I made a pact with him years ago that I would stay as long as he did, having no clue it would be this long. When he arrived and we thought of him as a sort of typical European modernist, I was a little afraid that we wouldn't get along, and it took a few weeks only to see that that was wrong. We have such similar tastes and so many similar interests. We have the same heroes, as, for example, Stravinsky, Lutosławski, Debussy, and we are really sort of brothers. When a new piece of Esa-Pekka's arrives, I get it right away, and when I write him a piece, there is no translation required. In fact, I rarely give him any advice. He understands it immediately. And so he is the best possible interpreter of my music.
Is it true, as I've read, that the orchestra in your head as you compose is these days the LA Philharmonic?
It's true. I carry around an orchestra in my head, and it is the LA Philharmonic. When I sit down to write an orchestra piece, it's this hall, it's this conductor, and it's these players. I'm carrying a Rolls Royce around in my musical garage.
Former L.A. Phil music director Esa-Pekka Salonen said he first learned Stuckey's name after Stuckey published what's now the definitive book on composer Witold Lutosławski. Salonen says their shared reverence for Lutosławski was their first connecting tissue, and he told the L.A. Times that Lutosławski's influence can be heard in the very controlled way Steve builds his harmonies and form. But Salonen and Stuckey would soon find they connected on a variety of levels.
I cannot even remember exactly the first time I met him, but I do remember how much I liked him straight away. Steve always got along very well with Scandinavians and Nordic people. There's something about the sense of humor. We connected fast and deep straight away. We both felt that there's so much to do, and we just got going. Every time we met, every time we spoke, you know, ideas just started flying around, and we had so much fun trying to imagine things. And so there was never a moment of stagnation in that relationship. And L.A. was his home, in at least in the sort of spiritual sense. He had many friends in among the musicians. He was very much admired and liked by everyone. And all the musicians could see the value of his work, not only his compositions, but also his personality and the way how he would stand for the new within the structure of the Philharmonic. He was my best critic. But I think most importantly, when I was done with my life as a music director at the end of, you know, a rehearsal day or after a concert or something like that, then I would go and hang out with Steve. I was able to close the door to the conductor existence and just be a composer with him. And I got my composer muscle moving. And that was incredibly important. He was somehow the conduit to the life of a composer.
You've probably seen some of the outpouring of love and affection among students of his through generations that he taught at Ithaca and more recently at Juilliard and all over the West Coast as well, teaching master classes. What an impact he had just as a teacher and as a person in these students' lives.
I think Steve profoundly enjoyed teaching, and he liked the sort of bouncing ideas back and forth, and he's playing something for the students or showing a score or pointing out some aspects of a well-known composition to them that they maybe weren't aware of. And then he would get a lot of delight out of seeing the sort of light of discovery radiating out of their eyes. And I mean, he was that sort of a person. He wanted to share. And he was absolutely unselfish in terms of really wanting to help his students along, not only in the process of learning to master the tools of composition, but also later on. You know, it happened several times that Steve would call me, even after I had stepped down in LA, to say that I absolutely have to listen to this piece by that young composer. And of course, when the message came from him, I always did. And this led more than once to commissions. And in fact, one of the very last messages from him I got was a score by a young composer he felt I should take a look at. This kind of concern and willingness to help never stopped.
Composer Esa-Pekka Salonen on his friend and colleague Stephen Stuckey. Stuckey passed away in February at the age of 66. Salonen will conduct a sold-out concert with the LA Phil called Radical Light, a concert for Stephen Stuckey, on Wednesday. And tonight at 10 p.m., I'm dedicating my Modern Times program to Stuckey's music, including a complete performance of the Pulitzer Prize-winning Second Concerto for Orchestra. And we'll offer more remembrances next week on the Arts Alive blog. That's at KUSC.org/artsalive. You're listening to Arts Alive. I'm Alan Chapman. And still to come on today's show, a film composer who's done it all. But first, movie critic Kenneth Turan stopped by the KUSC studios to talk to Gail Eichenthal about a star-studded remake of a childhood favorite.
Disney is opening a new version of The Jungle Book, and the 1967 version, which I enjoyed very much as a kid, is a hard act to follow. George Sanders, Phil Harris, Sebastian Cabot, how is the new Jungle Book?
Well, it's quite good. I mean, the tone is different in this one. It's because modern family films have to be dark as well as fun. So this is kind of there's tension and there's a jeopardy, much more so than in the animated version. But they have brought back some of the stuff. It's a very intriguing balancing act between this new kind of tenser version and the one from the 60s. They've brought back two of the songs, the Bare Necessities, I Want to Be Like You songs that people will remember. And really, it's the voice talent here that has made this film one of the things that makes this film so good. Idris Elba plays Shere Khan. Bill Murray is the bear. Christopher Walken, of all people, plays King Louie and sings I Want to Be Like You. Scarlett Johansson does a great job as Ja, the sinister serpent. And also there's great visual effects. I mean, this is really a film made for modern technology. It looks real. It looks like you have these animals walking around and talking with this little boy. And, you know, it's something to see. It's a really good family film.
So that's the new Jungle Book, courtesy of Disney, with music by John Debney and some great flashes from the past. And speaking of looking back, there's a new series opening today at the Hammer. And this is part of UCLA's Film and TV Archive, of which you have been a fan for quite a while. And this is co-curated by a woman that teaches at Chapman University, Emily Carmen. So what's her take?
Well, this is a really fascinating series. It comes from a book that Emily Carmen wrote. The series is called Independent Stardom on Screen. And it's kind of a revisionist look at some of the female stars of the 1930s. I mean, the kind of standard history of Hollywood says that stars were kind of like indentured servants. They had no choice. They just did what they were told. And apparently in the 30s, there was a series of women stars who managed to become independent contractors and managed to actually have certain amount of influence, much more than was previously known, on not only on the roles they played, but on who directed, who wrote, who did their costumes. They really used their clout as they got more and more celebrated to really help influence the projects they made. And this, you know, Emily Carmen found this out by doing a lot of research in archives and looking through contracts. This is stuff that really hadn't been known before. So it's fascinating to know this and to see some of the films that resulted.
And, of course, seeing some of these films from the 30s on a big screen is a big treat and an all-too-rare treat. Tonight, Ball of Fire and True Confession. Tell us a little about those.
Well, you know, often in the series they pair a more known film with a lesser-known film. And Ball of Fire is fairly well-known. It's directed by Howard Hawks. It's a Charles Brackett, Billy Wilder screenplay. And it's got a really great kind of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs premise, but kind of done screwball style. Barbara Stanwyck is the Snow White character. She's a nightclub singer who's on the run from the law, and she takes refuge in this house in Manhattan that is peopled by seven scholars who are working on an encyclopedia. They've been working on it for years, and they're up to the letter S, and they're slogging through it. And Gary Cooper is like, you know, the world's most handsome scholar, and his specialty is slang. So naturally, Barbara Stanwyck's character knows a lot of slang, so they hit it off, and hilarity ensues, as they used to say.
And she plays a character called Sugarpuss O'Shea, so it's worth seeing just for that.
And the other film there is, you know, this series has three films by Carol Lombard. She's the only actress who has three films, and each of them shows a different facet of what she could do. And True Confession is a film not often seen. She co-stars with Fred McMurray. She plays someone who's can't tell the truth. She's like a compulsive maker-upper of stuff. And Fred McMurray plays a lawyer who cannot abide a lie. So they have a very interesting marriage.
You note in your article in Sunday's LA Times on the subject of this series that Fred McMurray sports a pencil-thin mustache.
Yes, maybe people will see this and those will start to come back into style. Who knows?
All right. So we kick off tonight with this new series at the Hammer, Independent Stardom on Screen, Freelance Women in Hollywood. Kenny Turan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Gail.
That's the Independent Stardom on Screen series, part of UCLA's Film and TV Archive. cinema.ucla.edu for details. And Kenneth Turan and Gail Eichenthal also talked about the new remake of The Jungle Book, out this weekend in wide release. You're listening to Arts Alive here on Classical KUSC. I'm Alan Chapman. Next week, we check in with a young opera company in Redlands and lend an ear to the Here Now Festival. That's next Saturday morning at 8 o'clock. Listen to archived episodes of Arts Alive anytime with the Arts Alive podcast, and you'll find that at KUSC.org/artsalive. Coming up, we ask the Dean. But first, you wouldn't know it, but the musical mind behind the movie Shrek is the same one behind R-rated thrillers like Man on Fire. And tonight you can hear his first attempt at scoring a political courtroom drama. We have more from contributing reporter Tim Grieving.
Harry Gregson-Williams is an England-born, classically trained composer who's been busy in Hollywood ever since the mid-90s when he began apprenticing for Hans Zimmer, writing additional music on testosterone-fueled action movies like The Rock. One of his first big solo assignments was the DreamWorks animated movie Ants, which set him down a path of scoring animated family fare, most notably the Shrek series. But he's also accompanied plenty of movies for grown-ups, especially in his work for directors like Tony Scott, Ridley Scott, and Ben Affleck, from a period epic like Kingdom of Heaven to a bank heist thriller like The Town. He most recently scored Ridley Scott's gigantic outer space drama The Martian, and tonight his newest music will be heard in a much smaller scale film on the small screen. The HBO original movie Confirmation stars Kerry Washington as Anita Hill, the law professor who accused Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas of sexual harassment in 1991.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thurman, members of the committee, my name is Anita F. Hill, and I'm a professor of law at the University of Oklahoma.
I read the script for Confirmation, and to me it read like fiction, but I soon discovered it was, you know, an event that actually happened. And I came to these shores in June 1995. And so I wasn't aware of this incident at all. This girl was dragged through a kind of kangaroo court for telling the truth. The film's not really concerned with he said, she said, and who actually was telling the truth, because we don't know. But that really intrigued me. And in a way, it sort of plays like a documentary. So I thought it would be really a fascinating thing to do, and I haven't really done a movie like it.
How much did you want to tap into an Americana sense or a traditionally American politics sense?
Well, I felt in terms of instrumentation, I could feel this was going to be an organic and light orchestral score. I used a chamber orchestra, not a big symphony orchestra. Because at heart, you know, this is the story of two people. With Anita, her theme when I started working on this thing, it felt like she needed something simple yet strong, and sort of clear and clean. And often her theme is heard on two clarinets and grows into a piano thing. Clarence, because he kind of represented the establishment or the courts, it felt like a brass instrument. It's actually a solo French horn I used on him, and that gave him a certain integrity which I felt he earned. I'm up until this point, you know, the guy had an unblemished record. A lot of people believed in him just as a chap, as a guy. So his theme is quite robust and almost rotund. There was the procedure, the kind of ridiculous procedure that this nomination and ultimate confirmation, the way that it took place, it seemed to me that I could almost write a theme for that, for the process, if you like. And that wouldn't be languid, and that wouldn't be smooth, and that would be, you know, it would be quite busy and purring around underneath the scenes. So propelling us through scenes.
You've really avoided being typecast in any one genre. How do you think you've avoided that, where some composers have really been typecast or pigeonholed?
I'll put that very much down to some very fortunate occasions. I see the last 20 years as involving two kind of strands of film score making. You know, one that started with Ants and led to Chicken Run and led to the Shrek franchise and Arthur Christmas and all these wonderful animations, you know, during which time I had young children. So it was really great for me and seemed to really stimulate me creatively. And at the same time, the other strand that took shape quite unexpectedly, you know, was with Tony Scott and Antoine Fuqua and Ben Affleck and Joel Schumacher, these thrillers. You know, I'm about to start Ben Affleck's film Live by Night. I just saw the first cut of it the other day. It's really exciting. You know, I find myself very fortunate in the situation where I would be asked to do movies like that, as well as a Shrek or a Chicken Run. And they're very different, but, you know, at heart, they're kind of similar. I mean, you know, in Shrek, there's always something to pull on the heartstrings. There's always an emotion. There's always an emotional arc for a character. And, you know, that will be the same in Gone Baby Gone or The Town or in Man on Fire, dealing with a human emotion. You know, just because there's a bunch of ants or a bunch of chickens running around for 90 minutes, that's what we're really doing as film composers. We're trying to scratch the surface and get underneath that and find the sort of humanity in the situation.
Confirmation, starring Kerry Washington and with music by Harry Gregson-Williams, airs tonight on HBO at 8 p.m. For Arts Alive, I'm Tim Grieving.
Now here's Gail once again with a new question for Dean Rob Cutietta of the USC Thornton School of Music.
Our question today comes from Christine and Daniel, who wonder why it seems that there are so many pre-1700s compositions, manuscripts, lost, forgotten for centuries, only to be rediscovered in the 20th century. And that's a really interesting question, Dean Rob.
Yes, that really is an interesting question, because it does seem like you pick up the newspaper every day and some lost piece was suddenly miraculously found. I went to Adam Gilbert on this, and who heads up our early music program, And he explained this. There's actually four reasons for that perception. First of all, we've always been finding music. This has always been the case, that lost pieces have been found. People were already collecting and preserving pre-1700 music in the 18th century. Christopher Columbus's son was an avid collector of musical manuscripts, for example. So people have always done this, and we find that since people have always been collecting these things, that we find letters knowing that pieces are out there and we just haven't found them. There's one composer, Baptista Martini, who actually wrote that he had found some pieces, but then they had been destroyed because they were used to clean a hunter's musket. So this is not a new phenomenon. We probably know about it more because you hear about it on the radio or you're listening to KUSC, where we would tend to talk about things like this. So the first answer to that is things have been being lost and found for centuries, and they've been valued, which also means, this becomes important later, that things are being put in libraries even if they're not known what they are. Number two is music was often discarded or just fell into disuse because it wasn't the most current thing. Really, until we get to Mahler and Strauss, what people wanted to hear at concerts was something new, the new music of today. And so once something got old, a classic example of that is Bach. You always hear he was old-fashioned by the time he was considered old-fashioned because people wanted new. They didn't go to the concerts like we do today to hear something a couple hundred years old. That was not in the mentality. It was put somewhere and wasn't being paid attention to until somebody decided that it was important music and brought it back. That took a shift in mentality. It took a shift that, oh, what was behind us was actually valuable and important. It wasn't just old-fashioned and now we have the good stuff today. So that's number two, is that there have been changing thoughts. Third is nationalism that really was big in the 20th century. You could really attribute this to the wars. So much was destroyed of heritages, especially in Europe, that it became very, very important to preserve the heritage of different countries. So it became important to start looking for these pieces that were supposedly lost or not even known about, had been forgotten is probably the best word. So nationalism of the 20th century really, really did that. And then the fourth thing is the emergence of this whole idea of performance, historically informed performance, being something worthy of studying. In other words, doing the music of Haydn in the way Haydn would have heard it, which takes a lot of research. There's PhD programs that have just emerged all over the world that study this. So when you have all these scholars, especially these young scholars doing research, naturally you have more people looking. Naturally, more things are going to be found.
And I would also add, just from my perspective, that the democratization of the commercial recording industry has made, there are so many, you know, people can do their own recordings and send them out, and they can record anything they damn well please.
That's right.
It doesn't have to be yet another Mozart Jupiter Symphony, and that began to change in the last 25 years or so with the technology.
Yeah, they don't have to worry that it's going to be a bestseller and thing. And really, the internet. So many collections are just being digitized, so you don't actually have to go there. You could actually do your research online. So there's a lot of reasons why it's still continuing that we're finding these lost pieces.
And that's happy news. Thank you so much, Dean Robb.
Thank you.
Do you have a question for the dean and his team of experts? Send an email to askthedean@kusc.org. That's askthedean@kusc.org. Or you can submit a question on Twitter. Our handle is @classicalKUSC. Just use the hashtag KUSC, AskTheDean. And that wraps up this edition of Arts Alive for Saturday, April 16th. The technical director is Mark Hatwan. Kelsey McConnell is the executive producer. We had help this week from contributing reporter Tim Grieving and KUSC's Gail Eichenthal. Thank you also to Sheila Tepper. And I'm Alan Chapman. Brian Lauritsen will be back with you next week. Have a great weekend.